Okay, so now both recorders are live, and as I said, when it was off, I'm going to start by reading a statement and so on and so forth. So today is Friday, April 17, 2015, and we're participating in an oral history interview with Dr. Wesley Johnson. We're meeting in a suite in the Sheraton Hotel, downtown Nashville, Tennessee, during the annual meeting of the National Council on Public History. This interview with Dr. Johnson is part of a projected series of interviews with founders of NCPH and the modern public history movement. Sponsors include the National Council on Public History and the National Council on Public History's Council of Past Presidents. My name is Philip Scarpino, a member of the Council of Past Presidents and Director of Public History at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. Also present and participating is Barbara Howe, a member of the Council of Past Presidents and retired as Director of Public History at West Virginia University. Wesley Johnson was the founder of the National Council on Public History, founder and first editor of The Public Historian, and he also helped to establish the public history program at the University of California, Santa Barbara. So, as I said before I turn the recorder on, before we begin, I want to ask your permission to record this interview, to have the interview transcribed if we have the funding to do so, and to deposit the interview and the transcription with the IUPUI Special Collections and Archives, National Council on Public History, for the use of their patrons.
The answer is a hearty yes.
Okay, so now we're going to start with a hard question. When and where were you born?
I was born in Mesa, Arizona, a semi-suburb of Phoenix, Arizona, in April 28, 1932.
Okay. And who were your parents?
My parents were G. Wesley Johnson Sr., my father, and my mother was Zoe Hansen, S-E-N, Johnson, both of Phoenix at that time.
And did you grow up in that area?
I grew up in the suburb of Mesa for a few years. We moved to Phoenix in 1940, and from 40 until 1951, when I flew off to Harvard, the next 11 years I was in Phoenix and doing a lot of things.
So when you think back to your childhood in Phoenix, what stands out about growing up in that part of the country?
Well, the most important thing to note is Mesa was a nice town of about 6,000 people, and I was there until I was nine, mm-hmm. when my father decided to move to Phoenix for employment. I was very unhappy because in Mesa it was a small town, I knew everybody. Suddenly I was plunged into Phoenix in a big school. But after a few weeks, I began to understand I was going to meet more people I had never seen before. I was going to meet people who were of Greek origin, of Jewish origin, and so forth. I was in practically a Mormon isolated place before. So that was a turning point. I like to think in terms of turning points. Turning point in my life was leaving the, at time, boondocks, and going to Phoenix. Today, Mesa is 480,000.
We wouldn't characterize it as a boondocks today.
No, no.
So what were you interested in high school?
In high school, I went out for the Mustang Roundup, which was the newspaper, and served on that for several years as an associate editor and a cartoonist. I was a cartoonist in those days. And I did a weekly cartoon comic strip. But by the time I was more mature in the high school, I became senior class president, and at that time several of us determined in our junior year that we were not too happy with the fact that the school newspaper had an advisor who was kind of an imprimatur. Nice guy, we loved him, but sometimes he would veto what we wanted to say. So some of us had a meeting in a cafe and said, let's found an independent publication. But we didn't have any money. And what we did was to found a publication. It was, first of all, going to be called the Radical Newsletter. My mother heard this, and she said, look, you guys are getting in trouble. She said, well, can't you change it to something else? Well, we've got a lot of things. And she said, why don't you call it Fadical? In other words, you're going to report on high school fads. Nobody's going to go after you if you say that's what this is about. So we did. And for several years, we printed on yellow paper something called the Fadical Newsletter. We're not allowed to distribute it on campus, but guess what? In those days, for 2 cents, you could mail out a 3 or 4 page newsletter. And so we immediately had a circulation of about 400 or 500 people. And that got me into two kinds of journalism, official journalism in the high school newspaper and underground journalism on the Fatical newsletter.
So as a young teenage high school student, you were an editor, a leader, and an iconoclast.
Exactly.
Stuck with you for the rest of your life.
Good preparation.
Good preparation for what came later.
Yeah. I think that's one reason when the I interviewed for several places, the guy from Harvard came, and I walked in this immense double-breasted suit with my hair plastered down, and, you know, not quite the Harvard style. And first of that, man, we're not going to go anywhere with this. But I think, believe me, I think the fact that I told him about my activities in this underground newspaper, and we were not really radical. I mean, you know, we were what's the guy without a rebel without a cause. We had no causes in those days. Banned the bomb. I mean, everybody did that, but I mean, beyond that. So anyway, that was the way in which I got into publications and so forth. And I think that influenced the man who interviewed me. He was from the School of Education at Harvard. Next thing I knew, I got a letter a few months later and sent me to Harvard. Now, in going to Harvard, one of the first things I did was to check out how I could become a member of the Harvard Lampoon, which is the oldest humor magazine and feature magazine in the United States for college campuses. It's modeled very much on the English journal at that time was famous, called Punch, mm-hmm. which is a journal of cartoons and satire and so forth. And that was our model. And so but the Lampoon was also a social club. And so you had to go through a period of being harassed and doing dumb things, taking breakfast in bed to some of the members and so forth. And a lot of interesting people, about half the staff were actually people who were interested in putting out a publication. The other half were legacies or various kinds of people of high station who wanted something on their CV, and the Lampoon looked good. Yeah. And they didn't do anything. So I was in the group that looked like they were going to do something. And so a very exciting thing happened to me. They said, well, okay, you guys have gone through the pledge period of several months. Now, tomorrow night, a person will come and knock on the door and let you know whether you made it or not. So, you know, they said, so it was be home after 7 o'clock. 8 o'clock comes. My two roommates say, well, gosh, where are they? I say, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock. What's it looks like you didn't make it? I mean, they're not even, how discouraged can they be? I don't know. I thought I did very well during the pledge period. I had a lot of ideas. I did some cartoons, articles. Finally, 11 o'clock, knock, knock, knock. And I was stunned. Two of our more illustrious members, John Updike,
oh my goodness,
was at the door. Also, Sadri Khan, who was the son of the Aga Khan, who at that time was reputed to be the richest man in the world. Mm-hmm. So Sadri and John came in, hugged me, and congratulated me on being elected as an editor of the Harvard Lampoon. And wow. that set in motion the parameters of much of what I did at Harvard. I did go to class, and I did do honors in history.
You know, but, you were a history major.
Yeah, a history major, honors in history, yes. Uh-huh.
Did you ever think of a school other than Harvard?
Yes, oh yes. With my high school friends, we got catalogs. We were very diligent. We sent away for catalogs in the days because the high school library didn't have anything. And we got catalogs from Yale, Princeton, Stanford, and I think Chicago. I believe with the four or five schools. And I actually applied to Stanford and was admitted to Stanford, and then I applied to Harvard. And a moment of truth came when I had to decide between the two. And I thought, well, look, Stanford's just up the road from Phoenix. I've been there. I know all about it. In Cambridge, Mass., I've only visited once, so I think I would rather go there. So anyway, that was it.
It was a teenage boy rule. How far can I get from home?
That's right. That's right. That's
still
right.
Have
and
mom and
I,
pay for
and
it.
I had a yen to kind of get to know old Boston and all those places, yeah. So I, you know, go west, young man. In my case, it was go east, young man.
So if I did my homework correctly, you started at Harvard in 1965, is that right?
Oh, no, sorry.
55.
51.
51.
Okay.
51 I started. 51. Fall of 51 I went to Harvard.
Yes.
Yeah.
And graduated in 55.
And 55, right.
Yeah, okay. All right, so after you graduated, you did an LDS mission?
That's right. I was of the LDS faith, and I had wanted to do an LDS mission before going to Harvard, but the Korean War was on, and they were not allowing people to do that. And my senior year, my father called and said, well, he said, he said, how are you fixed for going on a mission? I said, yeah, somewhere down the road, not right now. Well, he said, the draft board's after you. The Korean War was still semi on. It was still, anyway. And he said, you got a choice. He said, you can go with the draft board and you'll be a private in the rear ranks, or you can go on an LDS mission. I said, but Dad, it's my senior year. I'm going to miss all the parties. And this is in the fall. This is terrible. Look, son, you got a choice, and that's it. And I said, well, can't you do something for me? My father was a lay bishop in this church, and he was a city councilman in Phoenix, replaced Barry Goldwater on the city council. So my father was a person of some influence. Mm-hmm. Said, Dad, can't you fix it? There's no fix on this. So I missed the last semester of my Harvard year and all the parties and so forth and so on, and packed off. But guess what? I was very luck of the draw. They sent me to France.
Oh.
And I had been studying French history and French language, so it was perfect. So I arrived in Paris and said, you know, thank God, here I am in Paris. And I was there for the next 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. That proved to be a turning point because it really got me interested in the broader questions of history. I had done history, American history and honors at Harvard, and now I was over there and able to, with a base in Paris, to see various places, to travel different countries, and most important, to get a feeling for the tradition of scholarship in Europe. And one particular thing that interested me was reading, going to the libraries there, and also buying on the stands, journals, scholarly journals. I never paid attention. We have them in this country, but I never paid attention to them there. It was big business. Mm-hmm. In other words, you know, every intellectual had a journal or something. And I found out very quickly that if you wanted to position yourself to be appreciated in the French intellectual establishment, you had to have your journal.
Is that where the public historian idea came from?
That's part of it. Okay. That's about half the story. Okay. I was terribly influenced. These French intellectuals had their journal. I'm going to have a journal someday, you know. This is great. So yes, that was one thing. So anyway, that was a formative influence for me for two reasons. One, it got me interested in journals, which later resulted in this publication. And secondly, it gave me a much broader sweep of history than just American history. I got into French history, Italian history, German history, and so forth. And I adopted a worldview of history, and that really informed what I wanted to be. My parents, this was a slight problem. My parents, I was not a scholarship boy. My parents paid for my way for Harvard. We paid our way. But in return, they are expecting me to come back and go to law school. The family, my uncle was retiring in a few years, and the family needed a lawyer, an attorney. I was the designated player. And so I said, well, okay, look, applied to law school, got in several places. After I got back from France, applied to law school. I did a short hitch in the reserves for 6 months, and then I went. Time to go to graduate school. And what I did then in, let's see, it must have been 56, I guess. I've forgotten. Anyway, exactly, the date's not important. When I came back from France, I decided to go to law school. And I told my dad, I said, Dad, I'm going to do this. And he says, you try it. And he said, if you don't like it, he said, then you can go ahead and this confounded idea of yours to become a teacher of history. Well, you see, in my mind, I wanted to become a professor of history. A teacher of history didn't describe what I saw my mentors at Harvard. They were in public service, they were doing this, they were grantsmen, you know, advisor to Ike Eisenhower, so forth and so on. That was the professor I wanted to become, not just a history teacher in the back of the room. End of a report here. I went to Stanford Law School. Did not, very lucky to get into Stanford. I did not like it. I realized after about six or seven months that history and I were not mated. We were not meant to be together. I enjoyed it intellectually. It was stimulating and so forth. But some of my colleagues were terribly naive. They had late night both sessions determining whether you're going to have a BMW or a Mercedes, you know, and so forth. They weren't interested in issues. They said, get the degree and get out in the law firm and make a ton of money. Mm-hmm. That wasn't me. So I finished the first year and was ready to go back. And in the early summer of the year, this would have been 58, I guess. No, I'm sorry, 59, because I had gone to school. I spent 2.5 years in France and 6 months in the military reserve. So I had lost a few years. Went to I'd finished Stanford, and that summer, what am I going to do? My advisor said, what's your plan? And I said, well, I said, I've contacted several universities, and Columbia has accepted me to go. He said, well, I thought all your friends were at Harvard graduate school. I said, yeah, but I said, I was ready. I was kind of smirking, you know. No, Harvard's old hat, he said, the action's at Columbia. Columbia's in New York. After I've been in Paris, I said, you've got to really be established in a big city. It's cosmopolitan. I said, that's the life for me. Harvard is great, but it's very provincial. Anyway, that was me. And so I did. I went, and the idea was to go to Columbia for 1 year, get my master's. If I liked it, my dad said, I'll support you through graduate school. If not, then you get back to Stanford. I took a leave from Stanford, and they said, fine. And the dean said, well, why are you leaving? You've got a brilliant career ahead of you here. I said, dean's name is Spaeth, Carl Spaeth. Later became a good friend of mine. And he said, why? I said, sir, when I came to law school, I thought we were going to talk about the evolution of the law, the things of justice and mercy, all of these different things. Oh, see, he said, stop right there. He said, I've encountered your kind before. and he said, look, Mr. Johnson, you're here at this law school. This law school is committed to one premise. We are going to teach you to win the case. Win the case. That's all we're going to do here. All these other things are extraneous. I said, well, in that case, I said, I think I'm going to probably go off to Columbia. Then try it. So they gave me a leave. Went to Columbia in 1959, the fall of 59, and I loved it. I was delighted to be in New York. Within a month, I started dating a girl named Marion, who I married a year later and who is here today, Marion Ashby Johnson. And we got married after a year, so I lived in the dorms the first year. And I really liked it. It was more the European model. I mean, you know, there was no, law school was kind of like being back in a prep school or something. You had to be there, you had to have an assigned seat, you know, all this stuff. You know, Columbia was more like the Sorbonne. I had out of the classes at the Sorbonne, you know, it was freedom. You could do what you wanted, you know, the sky's the limit. And that's what I wanted to do. So to make a long story short, you've had my quick background in high school and in college. Let me just say one more thing, though. I was very grateful in later years to the fact that I went to Harvard, because as a kid from a very faraway place in this country at that time, Phoenix was kind of out of it. But on the other hand, I realized I'd had a very good high school education. Our high school was number one high school in the state of Arizona, so we had a lot of bright. But four of us are accepted to Harvard that 1 year.
What was the name of that high school?
North Phoenix High School. Yeah, and there were three other fellows and myself, all who got accepted at Harvard that year. It was kind of amazing. But anyway, at Harvard, I was very lucky to have some wonderful mentors. One was a man named Walter Muir, M-U-I-R, Whitehill, who was a part-time professor of colonial history. He was also the director of the Boston Athenaeum, which I think is the oldest private library in the country and has a lot of periodicals and so forth. And being an editor of the Harvard Lampoon, Walter Muir Whitehill, who has done a lot of publishing and so forth, took me under his wing and got me a guest membership in the Odd Volumes Club, which was a club of literary and historical people in the Boston area. Pretty high-powered stuff, and I went to this and I didn't keep my mouth shut and just listened. But it fanned my fires of ambition, because these are people who became publishers, critics, historians, government people, advisors to various people, and I could see a multifaceted career ahead of me. Whereas in San Francisco, had been Palo Alto in San Francisco, I could see the idea was to get a nice house in San Francisco with a view of the bay and sit there and argue cases the rest of your life. No. So at any rate, I'm very grateful to the Harvard education for expanding my horizons. Several members of my family were very unhappy and felt that I'd been spoiled by the Harvard education and that it's time to come home and get busy and earn some money and advise the family. So for some people in the kin, alignment of kin, thought I was a kind of a washout, you know, but I my parents backed me. They were wonderful. Even though my dad was a CPA, president of the Arizona CPA Society, had the biggest CPA practice in Arizona, and later it was merged to become a partner in Haskins and Sells, which later morphed into Deloitte. Mm-hmm. So he was an early partner in what is today Deloitte. So he had good contacts, and he could see me as an attorney morphing with his interests and so forth. So in a way, I kind of destroyed a dream of my parents, but I found my own dream, and believe me, I've never looked back. I'm never sorry that even though I go to Phoenix and some of my friends there have big boats off in San Diego where they have enormous houses on peaks looking over the desert and so forth, but that's not what I wanted.
So when you went to Columbia, how did that influence your career trajectory?
Well, I felt very much at home at Columbia because it was very cosmopolitan. I mean, Harvard was cosmopolitan, but Columbia about 10 times more. We had people from everywhere. It was laissez-faire. Columbia, you didn't go to class three times a week. You got a lecture one time of a week, and then you'd go to the library, read, study group. I had an excellent study group, so that was key to getting into a good study group. And I was elected president of the history club at Harvard for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And that was important because I was able to kind of renovate that group and decided to set up a speaker series. And that put me in touch with a lot of people, like some of my former professors, like Arthur Schlesinger Jr., mm-hmm. who later became on the advisory board of the Public Historian.
Right. The history group was at Columbia then?
The history group was at Columbia,
okay.
Yeah. But one of the speakers who came in was Schlesinger. Another speaker who came in was Alfred A. Knopf. Mm. That was very, very interesting. I worked it out so he didn't just come in and talk and walk out the door. I invited him for supper, and so he came up to Morningside Heights, Columbia, mm-hmm. 3 hours in advance. We had a very leisurely supper. That was a prima evening. And he said, before we end this dinner, he said, I'm not sure. He said, I know too much about what John Updike did when he was at Harvard. I said, well, he won honors in history, in English, and he did this and that. And I said, he was chief editor of the Harvard Lampoon. I was an associate editor and his right-hand man. I said, so I know him pretty well. And he said, well, what's some of the most memorable things you can remember about him? I said, well, first of all, that he and I were both cartoonists, and so we both not only wrote stories, but we also furnished cartoons to the magazine. One time we did a double-page spread, which means then that he wrote the information and I did do the cartoons. So I said we were a team for once, one time, and that was a rewarding experience. And he became a lifelong friend. Later on, he wanted to write a book about Africa, emerging Africa. And he had been there on a lecture tour for the State Department. And so for the next couple of months, I advised him and sent him books, articles, and I literally had two research assistants at that time and assigned one of them to get anything that John Updike wanted. Later on, he profusely thanked me.
So your dissertation was on West Africa?
Yes, let's go to the dissertation. Let's get off of the Lampoon. I, like many people at that time, were absolutely still enthralled by the French Revolution. I mean, it can still be enthralled today by the French Revolution, but still, it was kind of a renewal of interest and so forth. And so I fell in line, and my advisor was Walter Dorn, late of Columbia, of Ohio State, and had been brought into Harvard, I mean, brought into Columbia as their main 17th and 18th century Baroque historian. Very distinguished guy. He had taken a leave of absence for 3 years to become advisor to the General Clay, I think it was the time, who was basically the NATO ruler of Germany, or allies. He was the guy who was in charge. So Walter Dorn had a lot of academic plus real-world experience, and so I was delighted to be accepted into his seminar, which was another turning point in my brilliant mind, yet very Catholic in his taste, you know, and so forth. And with him, I decided to work on my master's thesis, which turned out to be a case study of three bourgeois French people on the eve of the French Revolution. The idea was to find out whether all these people were radical or whether they were, you know, whatever. And the case study showed that many of the people who were leading literary and intellectual figures were not that radical. They were fairly conservative. They were very happy with their station as people who were not, they didn't care about the aristocracy because they looked at them as fops, which most of them were, and people, you know, geared only to parties at Versailles and so forth and so on. But I found I was more attracted to Diderot, who published journals, who did the encyclopedia, my heavens, you know, and I studied those people and so forth and did my master's degree on that, three case studies of people on the eve of the French Revolution, preparatory for me then doing a full-blast doctoral dissertation on the French Revolution. I finished my master's degree on my honeymoon. I got married my second year. Mary and I decided we'd been going to get married, and I came back to, we were in the West honeymooning, and we came back to New York. I went to see Professor Dorn. He read that it's very good. He said, you're well positioned to move into now. You got to get the right subject, you know, for the French Revolution. Next morning, he died of a heart attack. My wife said, well, aren't there other professors? I said, yeah. I mean, I came here. This is my dream to work with a distinguished scholar of European history who's actually lived public history, being an advisor to the guy who's ruling Germany now. I said, this is the world I wanted to get into. And, well, man's gone. And they said, we're not going to replace him. Probably it'll take at least another year to find someone to replace him. And I said, so what I'm one of the higher-ups at Columbia at that time was Jacques Barzin, who was also the provost and a fairly well-known historian. Very bright guy, not particularly friendly. I mean, he was okay, but I mean, he was not the kind of guy you put your confidence in. And he said, well, you should go over and see Shepard Clough. And I said, who is he? He said, well, he's an economic historian. He's not too well-known, but he's well-versed, and he's done a lot of important things. He knows everybody in New York. And he said, that could be useful to you. So I went over to Shep Clough, enrolled in his class, and he became my advisor, and he said, we're going to move you into the 19th century. He said, the 18th century is great. He said, do me a favor, go to the Columbia University Library, the Butler Library, and report back to me what you find out about books on the French Revolution. Well, 2 days later, I came back kind of embarrassed because I suddenly realized what he meant. I said, I found 982 books. He says, well, I hope you got the message. He said, what can you add to that? Everybody and his dog, not only in this country, but in France, England, Germany, wherever, have been writing on the French Revolution. What can you add? And I said, well, I don't know. He said, look, move into the 19th or early 20th century. He said, let me tell you. He said, you've been a Mormon missionary in France. He said, you're uniquely qualified to do something that I have an interest in. He said, I'm an advisor to the UN, and I go down there, and this was 1959-60. And he said, we have coming into the United Nations people from the developing countries. In particular, we have a lot of people from French-speaking Africa. Very few people in the academic world speak French or know anything about France or, for God knows, for Africa. He said, you go down and spend a whole day there and I'll give you a couple of people to meet. So I went down to the UN, I came back, told my wife, I said, I think I've got a new career goal. That is not only to graduate in French history, but in French, we called it colonial history at that time, but with the emphasis on how the Africans organized to overthrow the colonial regime. That was what I was interested in, is getting to the Africans. I went to the oral history office at Columbia, which at that time was one of the few oral history offices in the country, founded by Alan Nevins. He was in retirement. I didn't meet him, but I met all of his seconds, studied oral history, and realized that by going to Africa, tropical Africa, black Africa, I could go out and interview people with public, and that would give me a lot of information. And then, too, if I could somehow get to the archives in France and in Dakar. Dakar was in Senegal, was the headquarters of the French Empire in Africa, and they apparently still had a good archive. So my mentors at Columbia went to bat for me, and I got what at that time was called the Cadillac of Grants. It was a Ford Foundation grant. I'd always been envious of some of my friends who'd gotten a year's grant to travel in Europe from Harvard. And I used to moan at the fact, gee, I gave up going to Harvard and I could have got one of those travel grants. Guess what? Fate gave me a roll of the dice in my favor. I was called down to Madison Avenue, the office of the Ford Foundation, and they said, well, Johnson, you got a lot of qualifications here. You know French and you want to do French Africa. We know nothing in this country about French Africa. So you're a pioneer. You would be a pioneer going into these places. And one person on the committee, the name Phil Curtin, later became a great friend. He was a professor of African history. Not too many African historians.
Slavery studies.
Sorry?
Slavery studies.
Slavery studies, yeah. And Phil Curtin said, well, he said, okay, he said, what we recommend is you go spend about half of your grant in Paris, going to the archives, talking to all the French administrative officials, then the other half of your grant to go to Africa and interview the Africans and get to know on the ground floor. So he said, we're going to give you a grant for 3 years. 3 years, all expenses paid, very generous grant, half in Paris, half in Dakar.
So, given where we're going to end up in a little while, as I've listened to you talk for the last few minutes,
yeah.
Several of the faculty with whom you worked were engaged with the public. I mean, they didn't call it public history in those days, but did that have an impact on you as you moved on with the rest of your
career? Oh, sure, sure it did, because William Yandel Elliott was a big professor at Harvard, and I studied government with him. Not they call it government there rather than political science. And he was always gone because every other lecture he was called to Washington. He was advising presidents, secretaries of state, and so forth. I thought that was pretty neat. When I got to Columbia, it was the same way. Brzezinski, who later became an advisor to several presidents, yeah. And who was security advisor and so forth, was one of my professors there. And he had already established a track record of advising presidents or secretaries of state and so forth. And I was spellbound in his classes by, he was an historian, political scientist, and what he was doing. So there was one man who became kind of a role model for me. And there were others. So yeah, there's no question that. And this was hard to translate to the people at home who said he's going to become a history teacher. Teaching in junior college, you know. Right. No. I want to become a historian, and I think said it, public history. I mean, I didn't know public history then, but I even said that phrase. You know, I mean, I'll tell you why. Because in France, it was very chichy at that time to be a public intellectual, and there were many people from different things who wrote for Le Monde and wrote for various magazines and newspapers. Who were public intellectuals. Maybe they were technically a historian, a political scientist, an economist, a gadfly who was bright. Mm-hmm. Public intellectual was in view. And that's what I had in mind. Well, I tried to explain that to some Americans. What's that all about? You know. So yes, the answer to your question is that I did have colleagues and different people I knew who for example, François Crouzet, Crouzet, was a big professor in Sorbonne. Mm-hmm. Luckily, he'd spent a semester at Columbia as a visiting professor. I was one of his students. When I arrived in Paris, he welcomed me with open arms and put on a big dinner, fetting my arrival. I mean, it was in my room. I had about 20 people at his house in Versailles, and my wife was... She didn't know too much French, and she later became very fluent, but at that time she was still beginning her French. And she sat next to a gentleman, and later on I said, did you have a nice time with him? He was on the other side of the dinner room. She said, oh yes, she said, he was very, very nice. We were able to speak in English. She said, he's very, very good. I enjoyed him very much. I said, do you know who that was? Well, I know he's a professor at the Sorbonne. I said, he's dean of the faculty you were sitting next to. And she says, shrank in her chair, but I later she did just fine. She did just fine. So, and it, go ahead now.
Well, when you took a teaching job, if I read correctly, at Stanford, before you graduated at Columbia?
No. I graduated from Columbia. Mm-hmm. I went on this big doctoral thesis grant of 3 years.
Right.
It's a Ford Foundation,
right.
Foreign Area Fellows Grant, mm-hmm. at the time. 3 years, all expenses paid. So a year and a half in Paris, a year and a half in Dakar. I was able to go to all of the archives and interview former governors, former administrators who had been in Africa. I got to understand the structure of French colonial life. And I found several people who had been very much in the vanguard of favoring independence for the Africans. There were an old guard who wanted to hang on to the colonial empire, so I had to steer between these two groups, and I found out who to talk to and not, so forth. So on. So, and that helped me immensely, because when I went to Africa, then I already knew many of the French who had been there, the good guys, and that opened doors for me in Africa, because I emphasized the good guys, the guys who are pro independence.
Right.
Let's get rid of our colonies. We have no business being there. And so that was very, very important.
What was the title of your dissertation?
The origins of nationalism in Senegal.
Okay.
That's not the exact title, but anyway, we can get that. And so what happened is then in preparing in. Originally, the topic was to be the origin of nationalism in French-speaking Africa, because my mentor, Clough, was a big specialist in nationalism. Gray Cowan, Cowan, was a political scientist who was my advisor on Africa. Clough on history, other one, political scientist on Africa. They both had traveled extensively. So I was extremely lucky to have mentors who had been around. Vyzinski, of course,
right.
He was a stellar person even at that time.
But all of French-speaking Africa turned out to be too big a topic?
I was warned of that. Okay, I was warned.
And Congo.
I'm going to do the whole thing. Once I got to Paris, I realized that the archives were vast.
Yeah.
And realized that, you know, once you got into reading all this stuff in French, you know, you don't go too fast. You read fast, but not too fast. You miss the point. I realized that Senegal was the capital of French-speaking Africa. That's where the decisions made. That's where the governor generals were. That's where the resistance movements that I was interested in started. So Dakar, Senegal, was the place I zeroed in, and that's where we went and lived. We traveled elsewhere, but we made our headquarters in Dakar.
Okay. And so was your first teaching position at Stanford?
Yes. A fellow named Peter Deignan, D-U-I-G-N-A-N, who was in charge of Africa collection at the Hoover Institution, and he was doing a great job in going all over Africa and picking up ephemera, all kinds of obscure publications of resistance leaders and newsletters from right-wing people who wanted to keep the colonies and who were against independence and so forth. Peter Deignan came and spent a couple of days because he knew I was in the archives. I knew the archivist and I introduced him to a lot of the people there, and that was a favor to him because from the Hoover Institution, he knew English Africa, but he didn't know French Africa. And so Peter Deignan was a person who said, you know, you really should come to Columbia, you should come to Stanford. I said, well, okay, that certainly would be on my radar. And he said, well, if I can ever help you, let me know. I said, fine. So towards the end of our stay in Africa, the last part of the so-called Cadillac Grant, I got a letter from the University of Chicago signed by Edward Shills. You ever hear of him?
No.
Well, Edward Shills was a great sociologist and one of the stars of the Columbia firmament, I mean, Chicago firmament at that time. I was blown over. You've been recommended to come here next when you finish your field work in Africa. Come to Chicago and become a fellow at our center here. And I'd love to work with you. I realize you're working on, by that time I'd narrowed it down, working on elites and the way the elites were able to organize people and this and that. A lot of recent graduates of the Sorbonne came home and they studied the French Revolution and they learned all about history and what to do. And he was excited about that. And my wife said, well, what does this mean? I said, well, I don't know. I had also, before we left for the three-year grant, I happened to take a trip to California just to visit family and so forth. An aunt who lived in the Palo Alto area. And I happened to go by to Stanford to see this guy, Deignan, who was telling us, hey, you know, don't overlook Stanford when you guys get back from your grant. And I met a guy whose name was Gordon Wright, later to become one of our biggest French historians, president of the American Historical Association. Gordon and I really hit it off well. Wes, you've got to apply to come here when you come back. He said, I've got a lot of material I can share with you. I was attaché, cultural attaché in the government in France from 45 to about 48.
And another example of a scholar who had a public life.
That's right, that's right. And he said, I knew all of these guys who are now presidents of these countries. They had come in because they allowed people from the colonies to come in and become part of their parliament. British should never have done this, but the French did. And so he knew all these leaders I wanted to interview and so forth, who are now back in Africa, who were out living history. I mean, they were making history. Gordon Wright, Professor Wright, he knew all these people. So it was just like suddenly, you know, having an address book. So that was a contact I had made. So end of story. When I had to make a decision, and I finally, my wife said, look, we've been in the East for a long time. She said, wouldn't it be fun to be out west where her family were in Utah, my family in Arizona? Wouldn't it be nice to be a little bit closer to where our roots are? I said, you're right. I said, you know, 4 years in Boston and 4 years in Columbia, it's time we go back to the West. So I turned down Shills thing. It was, I most of my friends said, man, you know, the Shills thing is the way to go. I mean, this guy is such a big powerhouse and so forth. But the point is, though, that Peter Dignan had been collecting all this stuff on Africa, and only one place in the country held materials on what I wanted to write about in the country. No, everybody else was collecting on English-speaking Africa, except Dignan. He was collecting on French Africa. So that's how it turned out on that basis. Family matters and Dignan, personal contact, Gordon Wright, and all these people, I wound up at Stanford.
Okay. And you were there until 1971, is that right?
Yes. I was at Stanford from 65 to 71.
Relatively usual academic position? You were teaching classes and
The first year, I still had, I had a grant from the Hoover Institution my first year to continue research and, mm-hmm. and my doctoral thesis. Mm-hmm. Then the next year, I started teaching, yeah, and I was an assistant professor, acting assistant professor, and I started classes on the first person to do anything on Africa at Stanford. I mean, from a history point of view.
Did you earn tenure there?
Pardon me?
Did you earn tenure at Stanford?
No, I did not earn tenure. And let me say this, and it's a big subject. I was of the Mormon faith. Okay, I'd done this 2.5 year mission for my faith. Mm-hmm. At that time, Black Power was at Stanford in late 1960s. The Black Power movement was very big. And I was recommended for tenure by my department. I had as many publications as the chair of the department did. I had a book and about 10 articles. But unbeknownst to me, there were certain people in the administration who thought it would be a liability to bring in a white Mormon to teach a Black Studies type course. Even though I had worked and knew all about Black Studies, I was an aide to Gray Cowan, who set up the African Studies Association at Columbia that later became the umbrella group for everybody studying Africa. I was in the ground floor of that and so forth. And so I was denied tenure. Later, there was a fellow who was provost of Stanford at that time, the number three position, who invited me to Claremont College, where he had then left Stanford and gone there. And this man called me and he says, I want you to stay here for 2 hours. I want to tell you what went on behind the scenes. He said, I'll never discuss this in public. I'll never write about it. But he said, you are a person I liked, and a person of faith. You stuck up for your faith. I think he was a Christian Scientist or something, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So we sat there, and he set out certain factions in the university, administration, certain other departments, who were against bringing in a white to do Black history. Now, he said, I had a very good friend, a high-powered lawyer in Palo Alto, who was one of the new lawyers in San Francisco, and he said, Wes, we're going to fight this in the courts. My friend who was at Claremont said, it's a good thing you didn't do that, he said, because Stanford would never have released any documents. You would never have gotten the documents you needed. Those would strictly be kept in the safe. Since nobody really knew they were there, they couldn't subpoena them. So I gracefully left. I had my final counsel with Meredith Wilson, former president of the University of Minnesota, who was chair of the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences, which is a big think tank in the Palo Alto Hills. I talked to him for about 3 hours. He was a former Mormon missionary, did part of his PhD at the University of Strasbourg and so forth, had a career somewhat like mine, but 30 years earlier. He said, Wes, sometimes you just have to bite the bullet, and he says, you're going to have to do this. He said, you can have a big trial, law case and so forth. He said, professors rarely win against universities. And he said, I think it's better for you to fold up, move on, and so forth. And he said, and get out of that, and I predict you'll have a brilliant career. But you get involved in this big lawsuit and so forth, it'll not be good.
So that's the point at which you went to Santa Barbara.
That's right. So meanwhile, I connections. It was Santa Barbara, and they needed an African historian. I flew down and was interviewed.
Okay.
My wife is thrilled to go to Santa Barbara because it's an art city. And she was in Palo Alto was okay, but for her, Santa Barbara was the Mecca.
Okay, we're going to make a transition here. Why don't I put this information in the record and then hand off to you, because I've been talking for a long time. So you see where we are in the...
I do. Okay.
So
did you go to Santa Barbara with tenure?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I left in 72. I arrived at Santa Barbara and was promoted to be from an assistant professor to be an associate professor with tenure. Yeah. And Santa Barbara was, briefly, it was a very congenial place. I'd been there before. I had an uncle who lived there, and so I knew the place. And Marion didn't, but she, my wife, but she was delighted because Santa Barbara has all these expatriates who had left Paris, Bucharest, Munich, wherever during the war, and they'd come to Santa Barbara. And so it was a very, very cosmopolitan city. And the university there was very hospitable to me. They more or less said, you can do what you want, write carte blanche, you know, and so forth. So that meant after several years, I was there doing African studies. And after several years, a friend of mine, John Driggs, D-R-I-G-G-S, was mayor of Phoenix, was an old friend of mine. And I was visiting Phoenix and talking about the fact, you know, it's crazy, this city is becoming one of the largest cities in the country, but there's no history of it. It's a city without a history. And I said, I even though I'm doing African history there, the president of the university gave a great speech a while ago calling on us to develop auxiliary fields. If you're a foreign area specialist, develop a domestic field, because the horizon for funding is not good. And people who are doing foreign area studies must understand we can't continue pouring money into grants for you. You may have to develop a domestic specialization that you can rely on for part of what you're doing.
So he was telling everybody at Santa Barbara this?
Everybody in the UC system.
In the UC system.
This is the chief mogul. Yeah. And so when I talked with John Driggs about the fact, well, maybe we could come to Phoenix and work on a history there. That would kind of help, you know. So I talked to my department, and they knew of what this thing was. I said, sure, you know. And so I applied to NEH and got a nice big fat grant to go to Phoenix. And that was very fortuitous, because that's where my public history career started.
Wow. Okay, I'm going to try to catch up a little bit. So you had many reasons to think about what would become public history.
Absolutely. It's all the way
from Harvard.
The French intellectuals and public intellectuals who were involved, professors who were not just sitting in the ivory tower, who were out doing things.
So
role models, shall we say.
Let's start to think a little bit about developing a formal program at Santa Barbara.
Okay, yes.
I'm getting the idea that it starts with this mandate from the head of the UC system saying, we're not going to keep funding you to go to Africa.
That's right.
And so because of your connections in Phoenix and your friend the mayor and your family ties, that looks like a good place to start. Tell us about how you think about the development of a curriculum or a program at Santa Barbara. You move from doing a history of Phoenix fortuitously to a full-blown
there
program.
There was a fellow who should be mentioned here, Robert Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y, outstanding American historian. He had been called in over the last 5 or 6 years to testify in water cases, litigation cases, what constantly taking a plane to Sacramento to testify. And he then began teaching some of his students about how a history historian could be helpful to the law in litigation as expert witnesses. And he said it could be expert witnesses in other fields. And so he was kind of teaching this part-time in his classes. And so Bob got the idea that maybe what would it be if we had some kind of a program in public history. Well, we talked about this on the eve of my leaving for Phoenix to take a year off to work on the Phoenix History Project. And NEH bankrolled the Phoenix History Project to recover biggest city in the United States without a history. I have to use oral history to contact all these people. The archives in Arizona was kept in Tucson, a rival city. They didn't collect anything on Phoenix. So it was kind of like a desert for written word. Oral history became the key. At Santa Barbara, then I went off and really got very much involved in community history and realized that that's what I had been doing in Africa. I had been interviewing resistance leaders in different cities and what the community was doing and so forth. So the pattern of what I was going to do in Phoenix was already set from my experience in Africa. I'd been there, done that. I knew what to do. Organized a cadre of about 12 women who were bored with being docents in the art museum, who wanted more action. And they then became my shock troop to go out and interview people. We had to do 600 interviews of people in Phoenix to reconstitute much of what had never been collected. It turned out the newspaper had a front page story about Johnson, professor trying to find the history of Phoenix, announced as a campaign for people to come forth. He's going to have several meetings at the Art Museum Auditorium for people to bring in their materials or come in and give us leads on any documentation you have on Phoenix of the last 50 years. One guy came in, I was mayor of Phoenix in 1935 and I kept everything I had for 3 years. My wife insisted I throw it away, but it's in my garage. I knew you guys would come sometime. And there were many people who had similar stories. So I was welcome. It was very gratifying. Welcome with open arms, made a lot of friends. But I really got into community history. So I came back from that year in Phoenix to get that started. I set up a staff. I had a professor from Arizona State to be my assistant, and he kind of ran the office when I wasn't there. I was there for several summers, and I would fly back and forth quite a bit. And that was great. What happened is that Bob Kelly was a gadfly. He liked to do a lot of different things, and his great goal was to get a grant? Fulbright. He got a Fulbright to go to Moscow for a summer and a whole year. And I was just getting back from Phoenix, and he said, Wes, you're going to have to take over this little public history class I have. I said, well, okay, but I thought I could be here while work with you and we could develop this. Yeah, he said, it's great. You and I can confer. Postal mail, close, and so forth. So Bob sailed off to Moscow, and I was left to run this little class, and we were now calling it a program, and we were able to, at the outset, get funding from NEH first and from the Rockefeller Foundation second. Those at the beginning and later, throughout the whole time I was in Santa Barbara until 1984 when I left for those, 8 years, 76 to 88, were our primary sources of outside money. I can't emphasize how key to developing the public history movement were those grants. We could do things, that we could go to Europe, we could do this, we could do that, we could import a speaker from here or there, so hold a conference wherever. We had carte blanche to do a whole range of things we could never have done on a university support.
Let me, what year does Bob go to Moscow?
He goes to Moscow in 70, late 70, and in 78, he's gone during late 78 and 79.
Okay,
so he is gone at the crucial time when he and I were not talking about something like the NCPH.
Right.
That grew out of things I can tell you that.
Okay, let me go back for one time. Who comes up with the term public history?
Bob Kelly called his class.
Okay.
In public history.
Okay.
And for him, it was developing a class, and he hoped that maybe some of our students would go to other universities and replicate his class on public history. That was his goal.
And it was mostly looking at litigation and expert.
Well, that was his big experience, but you know, he had people do community history and so forth, and other things, mm-hmm. and that's where I fit in because okay. I had a lot of experience that he didn't have.
Okay.
So we fit together, you know, very, very well.
Okay. So were you or Bob, do you know, aware of or had contacts with groups like AASLH or the National Trust or Society of American Archivists? Were you connected in those worlds at that time?
Not initially, but believe me, once I got into this, I became very connected.
Okay.
But yeah. I had a glimmer of what, to me, it was community history, what could be done in this country. And I knew these organizations who supported this. Mm-hmm. So when I went back to Santa Barbara in 2 or 3 months, Bob and I conferred, and then he flew off, and then I was there to run the program. And by this time we had sent flyers out that we were having a program, an MA in public history at Santa Barbara.
So you did start with the MA first.
Yeah, and then we had the PhD program. Yeah, and then what happened is in the next year or so, we convinced Rockefeller that we needed to have some doctoral students, so they gave us, 3 years of grants to bring in doctoral students, 5 or 6 each year, so that that became a nice card in our hand to be able to offer these very fat fellowships.
Did you and Bob write those NEH and Rockefeller grants together, or did you mostly do it, or he did?
He wrote several himself, and I wrote the rest, so
okay.
I continued doing it. So, no, we just collaborated, and the collaboration was more, each man did his own thing. But he wrote one of the original grants. I already had experience, by the time I came back there, though, I was an experienced person in grant writing because I got a $200,000 grant from Rockefeller where I made contacts to set up an advanced program for people who want to get a doctorate in African studies at Stanford. And I wrote up that program and chaired it for a while until I left. NEH I worked with on this Phoenix Project. So when I came back, I had both these foundations I knew, and I went back many times asking for extensions and so forth. So I was extremely lucky to be wired in to two foundations both of which were expansion minded and who seemed to like the idea as we were developing it of public history. I mean, they could see an embryo here. There was something really coming. And so anytime we had an idea, we could call up, and almost always they said, go for it. For example, for the public, we started at about the time Bob was leaving, or before he left, we started, we had people coming to speak. We located a wine historian and then a historian of movies and this and that, all people who were, we proclaimed as public historians. And they came, you're a public historian. You didn't know. No. And so we did that, and I think that we got a backlog of talks of these speakers. The NEH gave us a grant to improve this. So for 2 years, we had money to bring in any kind of speaker we wanted. We were trying to locate people who were public historians, even though when you said you're a public historian, yeah, that's not me, you know, and so forth. But they were. Mm-hmm. They were working at banks. They were working at museums. They were working at historical societies. They were working at labor unions. I mean, all across the board, we were out trying to find these people, bring them in, and they would talk. And of course, several of them said, well, you know, thank God I'm finding my identity here. You people call it public history, that's fine, whatever, I'm glad to accept it. Because I've been ostracized by the AHA and the OAH won't speak to me because I don't have a teaching job.
So you just used your network of contacts to go out and find these people.
And we brought them in. And then at that point, Lydia Bronte, very important person, Bronte, relative of the famous Bronte sisters, was a program officer assigned to us by Rockefeller. And I said, Lydia, we've got all these people coming in, and we established a little thing here that I picked up. I was a fellow at the Newberry Library in Chicago for 6 months. And they had a program of occasional papers. They had visiting speakers. And they put out occasional, and we did, we put out five or six numbers of occasional papers about these speakers. I said, you know, we've got to be more expansive than this. I said, what would you think if we started the journal? She said, that's a great idea. I said, would you guys help us bank? I mean, I've discussed this with a few of my colleagues. They say, hey, Wes, you're way over your head. Nobody, including Bob Kelly, was interested in us getting into a journal, given all the problems. What they didn't understand, I'll be brief as I can.
Yeah, we should probably, if you want to tell this story, and then we can pick up later.
Okay,
this afternoon.
Okay, but this is important.
Yeah, oh, it's very important.
When I went to Stanford, I found a number of graduate students who were chafing under the arbitrariness and centralized organization of the Mormon Church, of which we were adherents. We were embarrassed by this. I said, look, every denomination that you have ever heard of in France, the Bibliothèque Nationale, where I worked for 2 years, I said, they have journals. The Jews have a journal. The Armenians have a journal. Greek Orthodox have it. The Catholics have 10 journals. We have nothing. All we have is centralized bulletins sent out from the Mormon Church in Salt Lake. I said, another fellow there named Eugene England, as the country, he had been editor of the Pen, a literary magazine at the University of Utah. Now he was getting his doctorate at Stanford. We joined forces and decided that we were going to launch a new intellectual journal in this community that did not have any intellectual journals. We did so. We sent out a flyer to about 300 people, and immediately we had subscriptions. We said, we're going to do a new journal, and if you want to, we think this is a place to publish what people want to talk about that can't be published in the centralized vetted journals at church headquarters in Salt Lake. Overwhelming response. Frustrated people all across the country who wanted to speak out on Mormon issues, but they knew that Salt Lake wouldn't print them. So it was an avalanche, and we were absolutely realized we'd hit gold, because there was a need.
What was the name of that journal?
Dialogue: A Journal of Mormon Thought. Dialogue: A Journal of Mormon Thought has prospered. As later this year, we're celebrating our 50th.
You say it still exists.
50th anniversary. It's the leading intellectual journal in the Mormon community. It spawned another 7 or 8 other publications who grew out. We blazed the way that it could be done. Other people came. And I co-edited that for 6 years while I was at Stanford. It took a lot of time away from my studies, but it was worth it, because I used my experience with the Lampoon and how to organize a magazine, how to do things, how to editorial get manuscripts in. You don't just wait for manuscripts to come in. You go out and solicit them. You go to conferences. An editor is an acquisitions editor. He has to constantly be on the move trying to find out. And so, end of story, Dialogue was launched. It got stellar reviews in the New York Times. Time magazine came and put Gene England and our photos in Time magazine. We're in Time magazine, a big article. And we found that the general public was pleased to hear that the Mormons are kind of coming out of their shell and becoming more a part of the public world. In the Mormon community, fear and trepidation that we were some kind of, you know. So we had our time with some of the people in the Mormon community, but there was an avant-garde there, thank heaven, who saw what we did. And money came in and so forth, and the journal prospered, and every 5 years we changed editors. It's been at Ohio State, it's been at different universities, it's been at Berkeley and so forth. The offices have moved around. It was 5 years at Stanford and other places. So in Santa Barbara, when I announced I wanted to do a journal, my colleagues said, Wes, you're getting over your head, you don't know what you're doing. I said, you'd be surprised. And I said, I know damn well what I'm doing. I have a plan to do this, and it'll be a success. You wait and see. Nothing but gloom and doom.
And it was.
But the thing, what saved me, though, was that the graduate students caught the vision. And so the graduate students, with no remuneration, manned everything, helped edit helped, it's the subscriptions, all the different things you have to do for a magazine. And that was, the first several issues were basically me, one or two faculty who came along with me, and the graduate students, and we did this. Once we saw, the magazine came out with the second and third issue, people began to, well, you know, this thing might stick. And I said, well, look, we have all the subscriptions we have. We have, here's the letters to the editor and so forth. And this is, another turning point came when I walked into the office of Chancellor, the chief man of the campus, the Santa Barbara campus, Robert Huttenbach, H-U-T-T-E-N-B-A-C-K, who was a historian who had been very big at Caltech and had been brought in as head of the Santa Barbara campus, a man of great vision. I walked into his office and I said, we've got a potential journal here, we have no money. Look at the response we've got. And he said, good God, this is amazing. And I said, I need a part-time assistant. I need someone who is trained in literature and magazines and so forth. I need scholarships for our graduate students to help out. And he put the phone and he said, get me the dean. He's in a meeting, get him right now. The dean walked in, yes. This is Johnson, he needs money. He's got a brilliant idea here for launching a journal. Our campus has very few journals. This has a potential. Work with Johnson, get him space, get him money, get him graduate student scholarships and so forth. The Public Historian was launched.
That seems like a good place to stop for right now,
okay,
right?
Okay.
I mean, launched, wow.
Yeah, that's like chapter one.
That's chapter one. Oh,